Austin. We have two more hours to spend on the pendant origination and its application in our lives. Just to give you a brief outline of what I intend, I would like to start with opening up whether there are questions. Then I have a few things I'd like to add. I would, in about an hour's time, suggest a small break, reassembling, and again, open up for questions and spend maybe the last half an hour in meditation with you. Such are my plans. Sometimes my plans do not turn out quite the way I have intended them. So I am open to this, but this is my rough outline. And I just want to ask what is left of this, what is left hanging or may be left hanging from this morning or from yesterday. Please?
We talked today about consciousness. Maybe you can tell a couple of words about mind.
Oh.
Analysis of consciousness, something about mind.
Mm-hmm.
How it works.
You don't like small topics here, do you? Huh? Did you have something particular in mind?
I'm a little bit confused now. What is exactly mind?
Uh-huh.
Consciousness, mind, and another aspect of, mm-hmm. of this.
Yeah, let's make an attempt. Let's start with debunking the word mind. The word mind in the English language is conveniently vague and fluffy, and the more you look at it, the more meaningless it becomes. It doesn't actually state exactly whether these are emotional components in there, whether these are mental components in there, whether they are affective components in there, whether they are volitional components in there. It's all lumped together, and we speak of mind as if we actually knew what we were speaking of. But in truth, we speak of a whole range of things. We speak of perceptual process, we speak of cognitive processes, we speak of conceptual processes, we speak of volition, we speak of tendencies, we speak of affect, you know, how we... The equivalent, or the closest equivalent to that in the Buddhist, in early Buddhist teaching is what we call citta. Now, the Buddha speaks of the citta as the continuum of our experience. This is the seat of our experience, where it isn't separated into mental and into affective. So it's the heart and the head. It's heart-mind, you know, basically. And when he speaks of developing that, when he speaks of purifying that, when he speaks of collecting that, when he speaks of this being exalted, or when he speaks of it being unshakable, then he always uses the term citta. Early Buddhism always uses the term citta for that. When he speaks of it analytically, when he speaks of mind as function related to sense bases, then he speaks of vijnana. So you have basically the same story that is referred to from two different corners. On one corner, it's called citta. And the citta is something that can be polished, it can be cultivated, it can be purified, it can be collected, or it can be distracted. Yeah. So this is the citta. When the Buddha speaks of particular aspects of that mind relating to the sense bases, he speaks of eye consciousness, or he speaks of nose consciousness, or he speaks of mind consciousness. The function of mind that allows us to actually understand things is referred to as vijnana. I said yesterday this is considered separative knowing. It's a knowing that splits. It it's that type of knowing something which brings us into a duality between me and world. So vijnana is a very partial way of knowing something. And one way of trying to understand this is that we, by experiencing something, seem to be under the impression that because there is something that is experienced, there must be somebody for whom this is happening. Because there is something out there, apparently in my senses, my eyes and my ears and my nose and my taste or my tactile sense, or my thinking sense, my manas. Because there is something happening out there, there must be somebody in here for whom that happens. And guess who that is? It's me. Now, this type of knowing something, something happening out there, thus there must be something in here that is me, is called vijnana. It's separative knowing. It's a type of knowing the world that always implies there is a me. And at the end of the day, me means pain. Me means suffering. Me means unsatisfactoriness. What hurts at the end of the day is me. It's not that things end, it's that I didn't want them to end because I liked them, and now they end. And so the me is the suffering bit. This aspect the Buddha calls vijnana. If all goes well, then in the process of dependent arising, actually something else happens. We come to a point where there is something called jnana. It's a knowing. I'm using the present continuous form in English of the ing, although it's technically not good English. Knowing implies a process type of understanding, and this type of understanding is not separative. It's knowing things as they truly are, as it is called in Buddhist teaching, yathabhuta jnana dasana, as things have actually become. We know them truly. This type of knowledge, this type of knowing is liberative, Buddhist teaching. It's that which makes us free. As long as we rely on vijnana, there is always an element of ignorance in there. In fact, in my personal black book, vijnana is one of the culprits. It is always dualizing things. And this has something to do with our sense bases. Nature, our senses operate, seems to insinuate something out there happening and something in here experiencing the happening. Imagine you stand at the shore and you look how the sun goes down. And there's part of you that says, well, the sun is going down. In fact, it's going down into the water. It's disappearing. And it just looks that way. You do know the sun is not going down. It's the earth that turns. And you know how fast it turns. You know that in 4 minutes it moves 1 degree. This kind of thing you know. And you know this is an illusion. And yet, when you stand there and you just believe your senses, empirically, everything tells you that sun is going down into the water. Now, vijnana operates in the same way. If you just believe your senses, then they cheat you. You cannot empirically know the so-called material world unless it is liable to cheat you in some ways. You feel this is solid. You do know this is not solid. If we look a bit closer, it's not solid. We know that most of what I touch here actually consists of space if you go at a subatomic level. We know that. And yet, if I just believe my senses, it feels solid. If I hit my nose against it, it definitely feels solid. So we live with this type of reality that our senses provide us with. And the implicit statement of our sensory experience seems to be there's a world happening out there and there's somebody in here receiving that world that is the secret protagonist of my life. Now, sometimes this guy tells me to go and eat the chocolate ice cream in the fridge. And sometimes that guy tells me, I wouldn't eat the chocolate ice cream because you wanted to slim down. And then the other guy says, well, if you can't enjoy, you can't really be happy. Mm-hmm. Renunciation is only one act of moving a desire from one corner to another corner. You can't really, as long as you have desires, you can't really get rid of desires. Go and eat that ice cream and be happy.
So yeah. This is the mind?
Both.
Persons,
They all live there, yes. And then I go there and I eat it. And then the other guy says, well, I wouldn't have done that if I were you, really. You know, they all have the same voice. They all use the same voice. They all say, me. You know, I'm talking. I know what's going on here. So, mind is a continuum of various impulses that come up, speak, experience, comment, quote.
Is this an example of citta or of jnana?
I would say it's more of an example of citta. Yeah. But the truth is, you cannot really distinguish those two. It's, again, like I said with the khandhas, you can look it from one corner, and then you would call it more citta. You can look it from one another corner, and you call it more vijnana. It makes sense to speak of vijnana if you're thinking analytically. It makes sense if you're thinking of development of mind, of cultivation of mind, to speak of the citta. Now, Buddhist tradition has been very ambivalent about that. You know, Buddhists are far from of one single opinion about the nature of mind. Early Buddhism says that mind is intrinsically luminous and pure. It's very important. The things that trouble the mind, the things that cloud it over, are things that come. They are not intrinsic. They are not in its nature. The mind intrinsically is pure and shining, radiant. I'm not inventing this. This is textbook Buddhism, early Pali, Anguttara Nikaya. So that means what actually is a defilement of mind, what is clouding the mind, what is disturbing the mind, is foreignness. It comes from outside. It comes to the mind. It is not in its nature. So this mind is capable of greatest happiness and greatest freedom. But unfortunately, it is also capable of pollution, trouble, and occlusion, and defilement. It can be corrupted. Yeah, so that's about as close as you could come to the English term mind. Now, Buddhism, in various stages of its religious teaching, has analyzed mind differently. Early Buddhism is quite adamant that this is one story. The mind is both pure in its intrinsic nature and it is corrupted through defilements coming from greed, from hatred, from delusion. Later Buddhism has... Yeah, there's two big movements. One movement has said everything is mind. You know, mind is your senses, mind is your objects, mind is the world. All you can see is basically modulation of mind. This comes very close to some of the Vedic teaching. Yeah, all is mother's play. Yeah, Leela, the great play, as they speak in the Vedic teaching. This is the Yogacara school of Buddhism. There's another school of Buddhism that has been very adamantly against that approach. This was the emptiness school, which starts off in early India and has been later taken to parts of Tibet, and particularly Japanese and Chinese Zen Buddhism. They have insisted that basically things are empty. You can't say that this is mind. The closer you look, the less you find anything that you could name. In early Buddhism, things are all very psychological. So, mind is the quality of the world you experience. Mind is the way you judge what you experience. All you basically can know is your own mind. The way your mind refers to the world is by giving it names, by structuring perceptions, by cataloging perception, by interpreting perceptions, by feeling happy or sad about them.
Is it true to say that my mind knows my mind?
You could say that, but I would suggest something slightly different. I would suggest that one part of your mind knows another part of your mind. As soon as you can name something, it becomes objectified. Yeah. You say a thought. And then something says, well, I am the one who knows the thought. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly have a self back again. Yeah, there's somebody in charge who knows things. And then you notice that, you move back. Yeah, and then there's the one who knows that there is one who knows the thought. Every time, yeah, you do this. And always a process called identification happens. We like to be the owner of our experience. Even if our experience is unhappy, we prefer to be the owner of our experience. That's very simple. You have a thought, it's a nice thought. There's a thought. Because it's happening here, then it must be for me, because obviously it wouldn't happen here if it wasn't for me. So I am the one who has this thought. Then the thought slightly goes, but before that I say, this is not just happening for me, it is actually my thought. Then the thought goes, and you have the guy who's left who has had the thought. Because this is a nice thought, I'm a nice guy. You know. I have a stupid thought, you know, it's happening here, it's my thought, and then a change happens. Because it's happening here, it suddenly becomes my thought. I identify with it. And then thoughts do what thoughts do, they tend to disappear, and you end up with the guy who is stupid now. So I identify with the content of my experience means, if I'm a happy person, if I have a happy experience, I'm a happy person. If I'm an unhappy experience, I am an unhappy person. And you realize very quickly this is a great source of suffering, because I cannot really control my thoughts. I can't even tell you where they come from. They just seem to pop up. And they come out of a sort of... It's like a poem. You read a poem and there's words on the page, but then there's something emerges from in between the words. Yeah, something becomes more, something thickens, a type of meaning coalesces and occurs. And then something beautiful that seems to almost lift off the page. You can't actually find it in the words, but it's something the words do to your mind that makes something happen. And it's not on the paper. You couldn't find it in the letters. Thoughts seem to go on in the same way. They kind of come out of a sort of a thickening of something in my mental part of experience. And then they do kind of a thing. They say, believe me, take me serious, I'm important, do something about me. Yeah? Think me to an end. You know, I'll be the end of all thoughts. This is a favorite thought. Ever had that? You can meditate. Just think me to the very end and I'll stop. I'll leave you in peace. Have you had that thought? Yeah. And you'll quickly know, thoughts are like rabbits. They multiply at a really frightening rate. Yeah. So you start off with one little single thought. Yeah. And you say, okay, you can get through. Fine, I'm not bothered today. Yeah. And he's taking a few friends along, and as soon as you're aware, you know, suddenly you get a whole people there. Yeah. And then it's really crowded and they all say, take me serious, I'm important, do something about me, believe me. Yeah. Mine always say, believe me. Mine say, they don't say, I'm a thought, they say, I'm the truth. Yeah. Yes. So, it's crucial to understand that we produce out of mind a self, and that production of self. In fact, it'd be better if we said selfing rather than having a self, because it's a process. We keep making a self out of contents of our experience. I've got a lot of money in my pocket, so I have a rich self. Money has gone out of my pocket, I have a poor self. Yeah. So the content of my experience becomes the object of identification. With that identification process, I create a self. Now, obviously, since the content of my experience is transitory, since it is changing, myself keeps changing. Yeah, and one of the kicks in having a self, in fact, one of the primary reasons why we establish a self is to create safety, is to create control, is to create permanence. You know, this is a psychological defense mechanism against a totally transitory world. And you know, it's not, as some people believe, it's just things out there changing. You know? We could live with that. But if we actually look a bit closer, we realize that the supposed protagonist that looks at the changing world changes itself. You know? Now, if it's not just the world that is changing underneath my senses, but it's actually these senses themselves that change, that means that has some very stark implications. That means I'm going to disappear sooner or later. It's not just the leaves are going to turn yellow and disappear. It's me that is going to turn yellow and disappear at some point. And this is an unpleasant thought. It's difficult for us to acknowledge the possibility of our non-existence. And much of what self is a defense against is our own acknowledgement of mortality, our own imminent undoing. This is threatening. To make peace with impermanence means you have made peace with life. It means you have understood a lot. And for most of us, we have sort of an intellectual acknowledgement of death and mortality and impermanence, and a tremendous psychological resistance against this acknowledgement. So we live in this kind of half world, yeah? We pretend to know, and yet we don't quite want to know. Yeah, we say intellectually, yes, 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 it happens to everybody, but truly we live as if it didn't happen to us. Yeah? And self is one of the prime tricks we use to do that. We establish an apparently permanent identity as somebody. Somebody clever or somebody stupid, or somebody rich or poor, educated or not, Israeli or Swiss or whatever, we establish some sort of identity. And we attach to that because it gives us a sort of strange degree of safety. You know, because it precisely is slightly abstract, it's as if we hover over the changing world with the help of our artificial self. And that has psychological reasons why we do this, but unfortunately it's not actually going to get us out of trouble, because however successful our self-creation is, we're nevertheless going to die anyway. You know, the things that we do not want to happen in our lives still are happening. We don't actually obtain any real competence in creating such a false sense of self. So, we have to, I think, understand why we do things. I secretly harbored a plan to write a book about the advantages of having a self. Because Buddhists always are rallying against the self and are speaking about the danger and the peril of self. But in some way, it's interesting to see why should we even arrive at trying to have a self. Because its disadvantages are so obvious if we look at it soberly. But in fact, we are afraid, isn't it? And one thing that makes us feel less afraid is if we can predict things. If we can give names to things. If we can control things. If we can refer to coordinate points. This has worked yesterday, it's probably going to work today as well. Yeah? We can fall back onto experience. So we build up a structure of a life, a structure of identity. If you look at something like possession, it's an absolutely abstruse concept. You know, the most violent act of possessing something is probably eating it. Yeah? You actually engulf it, you put it into your body. The oldest and most aggressive way of kind of engulfing something is to stick it into your mouth, chew it and swallow it down. And there's nothing you can even eat in the most obvious and grossest way of taking it into you, primitive act of appropriation, thank you. the most primitive act of appropriation doesn't really last. How long are you going to keep something if you eat it? You know? Does it really belong to you? It doesn't. You know, every single grain of rice you can put into you, you can't really keep. It's crazy, isn't it? It obeys laws. You know, you can obviously derive some digestive nourishment out of it, but there is laws at work which you can't control. You know, you're not going to tell your digestive system not to digest your chickpeas you ate this morning. You're not going to tell that. Your digestive system is not going to obey. It's here. It's happening. I'm going to digest it. Yeah. So we cannot really possess things. There is no truth and validity in the conventional notion of possession. Yeah. The foundation of civilization, the foundation of any culture, is the acknowledgement of personal property of a safe, a few bushmen or so, yeah, who have managed to do without. Is the respect of your neighbor's garden and his car and his wife. And, yeah. So we acknowledge this. And yet, if you look very, very clear, you cannot actually possess something. This is a total convention. And in a truth sense, there's no way you can possess something. You came into this world naked and you're likely to not take anything away. And even long before that, bad things may happen to it. Government may change its policy. War. There's all kinds of things that can happen. There is no genuine validity in a statement of possession. Yeah, if you look at this closely. Please.
So how come not to get to nihilism? You said we have to look at the dependent...
Origination.
How it relates to it. That it's not get to...
Nihilism. Well... It's bad taste to start with. It doesn't work. You see, human happiness is something that has somehow to do with our degree of being related, with our capacity to understand, you know, with our heads, and with our capacity of our hearts to live in an intelligent way our relatedness. You know, there's something in your heart that is capable of compassion. Your happiness cannot be separated from the happiness of the people close to you. We all know this. If we love, it's clear that we feel the pain of the ones we love. If we become a little more sensitive, we actually feel the pain not just of the ones we love, but of the ones who are basically around. And if you really take that further, you become aware that you cannot really be truly happy unless everybody else is happy around. So that you cannot base your happiness on isolating yourself. Because you become aware that you're more and more and more connected. And nihilism is a very bad ideology to live mm-hmm. conscious, connected community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's psychologically not very encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, in the Buddhist teaching, you find one of the reasons why he felt that nihilist doctrines were the worst of all is because they do not acknowledge that there is something as a connection. What we speak of dependent origination speaks about conditionality, about one type of conditionality. And there is a type of conditionality the Buddha called kamma vipaka. Namely, that the quality of our intentions that then translate into action, that the quality of the intention, whether it is wholesome or unwholesome, has a direct consequence. There is what happens is directly related to the quality of the intention that stands behind our action.
Who had this intention? Who has
this is not a good question. This is not a good question. You allow me to say. There is intention. If you look at yourself, you can notice intention.
What is myself?
Well, you sit there and you look. Right now I have the feeling that you have the intention to understand something. Yeah? I assume. So I assume the intention behind your question is that you're intrigued or that you'd like to understand something. Now, that I would think is a wholesome, it's a very wholesome motive. But I wouldn't try to build an identity out of it. You know, a few hours later you will try to go to bed and not understand something, but to actually sleep. Yeah? So it's not something that is a permanent condition. What you do is you recognize wholesome qualities in your mind and you foster them. You give water to the wholesome things. Please?
Yesterday you took us through this the links of the event origination, pointing out that at the point of desire and greed, this is where, when enacting them or being proactive, is the point of turn.
Yeah.
And you promised that today you would take us further or backwards or...
You want to cash in.
Please.
Good, I'll come to that in a moment. Yeah.
And you also promised transcendental.
Yeah.
Dependent origination.
And also and the connection between the dead and the promises.
Good. Good. I heard you. I'll promise again.
Yeah. You talk some about this morning. How I feel the whole thing. It's like all these models of the mind, like this flowchart. Like from one side, I'd say it's just a vehicle for us to get talking about this, but it feels like it's really far from the real thing. Like, you know, it's a model, so I can always it's just a partial view on reality, and I just and I can and I can find paradoxes on it, but it always gets the feeling that okay, it's something true, but some way I know that it's not. It's just a partial take. So I have a very ambivalent feeling about studying or constructing these models and what use are they?
What would you like?
Well, I don't know.
More facts? Neurobiology? The definitive blueprint of the universe? Clear set of instructions?
No, but I get the feeling that like this is trying to present itself too accurately. Like this is the links of dependent origination. This is how your mind works, and this sounds like too
neat.
Yes, too neat, and also this too humble.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. Well, obviously, you're right. This is a model. And one of the things we have learned is that models, however good, are never accurate. Yeah. There's always the dukkha factor. Yeah. The better a model looks, the more insidious is that particular part that doesn't work. So I am afraid I have to confirm you on this. There's much about human experience that is ambivalent. And I'm not holding it against you that you feel that Buddhist models of experience are ambivalent as well. Yeah. Now, what do you do with this, isn't it? If ambivalence is the condition, then how do you negotiate that ambivalence? Obviously, you can trash it and say this is just yet another reductionist blueprint of the universe. I'm not going to buy that. Or you can try to see whether you can get something out of it. What's the option? What's the alternative to trying to understand it?
Trying to understand this thing or life?
Well, I think, you know, if you recognize ambiguity as part of our existence, there are some things which are black and some things which are white, but a lot of things are, you know, are various shades of grey, and we can't quite... We know we're not quite enlightened, and we know that we're not stupid, so, you know, when do you believe yourself to actually be sure of something, and when do you believe that what you know is actually wrong and you believe something else or something new, or you go on? It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because if you just go on and see this, the mistakes or the ambiguities of things, what you fall back ultimately is the competence of your own critical abilities. And if you acknowledge to yourself that you're not enlightened, then you have a serious logical problem there, because you make something you know not to be perfect the judge of all other things. Now, I find that unpleasant personally, and I keep suspecting that I can learn. Yeah, and meaning learn means I have to put up with some degree of unpleasantness around something new. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make complete sense. It doesn't affirm what I already believe to know. And I, you know, as my personal experience, I know I have learned most in places I was willing to bear confusion, mm-hmm. or to bear the fact that what I believe to know is not affirmed. You know, we all hate that. You know, we have established with great sweat and effort some type of certainty in our lives and some type of experience, and then new stuff happens that doesn't confirm what we have put in so much effort, and that's why learning is unpleasant. It's easy if you know nothing, you know, you learn most, you make huge jumps, but if you have experience and if you've lived a couple of years and been around the block for a while, you're not going to buy any piece of candy that comes around, isn't it? So it's disconcerting. It challenges knowledge. It challenges depth of our understanding. I offer this as a reflection. I offer this as a model. This is an image. The image goes back to a set of teachings that have an authentic ring to them. You have mediated these teachings by me, and it's filtered through my own degree of ignorance. So you have all reason to be, you know, skeptical. I cannot offer you more than that.
I used to love these things, because I come from an analytical background. So
yeah.
I thought, oh, like, we have models, okay, we're going to solve this right away, and then I...
Graphically, right on a chart, on A4, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
X and Y axis.
Solve the equation and the answer, and then I saw it's really far from reality, but I noticed, like... it gives the tendency to give you a false feeling that you have.
So understood.
Then, so I got a little averse to it, so I thought, okay, I'll go to teaching that they're more like, I don't know, general teaching, or more like for teacher talking about their experience, but I leave this the models of the mind alone.
Yeah, I know that. I know that very well. I started off practicing, promising myself that I wouldn't read any books on Buddhism that didn't deal exclusively with meditation. That was one of the first promises I gave to me, because I spent much of my time reading books that had very little to do with my practical reality. And I saw very early on that in Buddhism it's possible to read very many books that have very little to do with your life. And I was clear that this was precious. Something in me knew that meditation was precious, so I wanted to make sure that I didn't read about things instead of practicing meditation. And that has definitely helped. But there is a point when you realize you need new maps. It's not because maps give you actually the experience of the landscape. They don't, as little as the menu gives you the experience of the food. But it helps. If you know a map to be a map, it helps you to orient yourself. It may help to actually chart territory you have already walked. Or it may give you a glimpse of territory that lies ahead. Not that you could use it when you read it, but you bump into that rock, you may actually remember that you have seen it on the map. Yeah. It may help you to corroborate, to confirm that you're on the path, or that you're off track. That's more. Yeah. So I think oscillation is probably inevitable. You have to oscillate between map reading and direct, immediate experience. I experience my normal life as that. The clearer I can say what's happening, the farther I am removed, the more abstract I am. Yeah. When I'm in immediate experience, it's all kind of a sort of a grunting suchness. Yeah, I can't think of it, I can't speak about it, I can't communicate it. The better I can communicate and convey it, the further removed I am, isn't it? And yet we can't decide to live just in one part. We commute, isn't it? We shuttle between an immediate degree of direct experience in our senses, which is kind of unquestionable. Now, if I look at you and you look at me angry and you tell me you're not angry, I will not believe what you tell me, I will believe what I see. Yeah. So the immediate nature of experience is always direct, more direct. But to be able to actually do something with that, to even think about it, let alone to communicate or to reflect it, I need to zoom out, isn't it? I need to take another level. And up there it seems to get clear and neat, and you end up with nice little pictures and charts, isn't it? And we can talk about it, and yet it's kind of abstract and removed. And we seem to be in that, for me that's a fundamental ambiguity of our lives. So I kind of keep swinging in and out from one extreme, hopefully taking something along. The immediate practical application of this is avoiding ignorance up here, you know? Avoiding blindness. If we miss out on ignorance, if we miss out on avoiding ignorance, I have to say, we'll end up down the line, somewhere down here with contact, passa, feeling, Vedana, thirst, tanha. If you're a really good meditator and fast, you can stop at Vedana. You can stop between passa and Vedana. If contact and then it doesn't move, the mind doesn't move. It doesn't jump into liking or dislike. You have to be really sharp for that. The more realistic point to actually break this whole cycle is a step later. You experience passa, the mind goes habitually into liking and not liking, and out of the things you do like, generally you develop a sort of desire, a wish it would stay or become stronger or become more permanent or something like that. And you experience thirst, you experience longing, you experience desire. And for most of the time in your practice, you will have to live with that experience. Your conscious acknowledgement that desire takes place and that you are willing to bear it. You're willing to be patient with it. This is where you have an option to jump off that wheel. Where you're prepared to actually feel the impulse without acting on the impulse. Every time you do that, you weaken the cycle. Every time you do that, you weaken the impulse. Now, if you're a meditator, obviously, this can be rather subtle. Yeah? You feel You sit here and you hear a nice sound. And there's something in your mind that registers sound, nice sound, Vedana, and something in your ear kind of growing long and tall, yeah? And you stay there and you notice that impulse. The study of that impulse, the willingness to actually truly experience that impulse, not the suppression of it, it's very crucial. The willingness to bear the impulse without engaging in activity to prolong it or to pursue it or to run out and listen and look what it was. This willingness is what strengthens the mind. That's one thing. It weakens the habit. Yeah? And you recognize how these things hang together, how it is the contact that triggers the pleasant or the unpleasant feeling, how the unpleasant feeling triggers the wish that it stop, triggers a slightly aversed impulse. This is the hatred side of things kicking in. You may have this kick in and you know, because you've done that countless times, you know when you follow that impulse, something that hurts more will happen. Something that is more unsatisfactory will happen. And out of that conscious knowledge, you're willing to bear with the initial unpleasantness of the impulse. You may use a wisdom aspect, and you may think that the poor car can actually not do really anything else but make noise. You know, it doesn't really have an option. When Ajahn Chah's monks complained that the road was too noisy, he instructed them and said, well, actually, the problem was not with the cars, the problem was with the monks. Because while the monks had perfectly, they had an option. They could leave the sound just be a sound. They didn't need to turn the sound into noise. It was a mental activity that declared that particular sound to be noise. It was, well, the cars didn't have an option. They could just, you know, they run or they stop. And they, as long as they run, they make noise. But the monks, who complained about the noise, they did have an option. They should please choose that option, namely to leave the sound at the sound. Yeah? In the hearing, just the hearing. So wisdom, if avijja is not in action up here, we still have consciousness. We still have Namarupa, well, we have a body, we have a physical organism, we still have six senses, and we still have contact. We're not going to turn into mummies just because we meditate. Buddhist meditation is not about absorbing into some kind of schizoid parallel universe where we don't feel and experience anything and just are left in peace. It's about being present here with as much of our capacity to be here as possible. The heart, the citta that is touched by the worldly dhammas and remains unshaken, that's the thing. You know? It's not the heart which is callous, indifferent and completely numb to anything that's going on around and thus cannot be hurt anymore. It's the heart that is completely sensitive, present, compassionate, and that doesn't wobble anymore, that doesn't tremble anymore. Now, what helps us to do so? What helps us to do that? Obviously, what helps is a range of virtues. It is necessary to have a clear theoretical understanding of that process. That's why it's important to do what we do now, namely to understand this picture. Even though this may only be partially verifiable in our experience, it actually helps us to be very clear that any form of desire, any form of thirst, we affirm and we pursue through grasping, through upadana, through enacting, through translating into practical steps to actually do it. Any such movement will strengthen, at the end of the day, desire. The more we manage to gratify our desire, the more the cat will come back. Yeah. The bigger its appetite will grow. So a satisfied desire is a very temporal state. Any desire satisfied will go into an opposite. It will very soon go into a type of longing that grows. To the degree we're capable of satisfying the desire, to the degree the longing will then grow. If we do not follow that desire, if we're willing to put up with the unpleasant sensation of longing, of wish, of desire, of impulse, then desire is weakening. It may be unpleasant to bear subjectively, but our impulse is weakening. Now again, I'd like to distinguish between needs and desires here. Yeah, this is crucial. The Buddha did teach a middle way. And the first application of this middle way is the middle way between self-mortification and sensory indulgence. This is crucial to understand. Now, culturally, the Buddha's day was a lot more inclined to self-mortification. Religious practices that came out of Brahminical ritualism, which was rather posh and was rather liturgical, chose, you know, 100 years before the Buddha, they chose to be practices that were ascetic. The Upanishadic religious reform movement that swept India shortly before the Buddha was a movement that said we cannot just sacrifice to our gods, we can actually do something about our liberation. And some people chose to do, they chose hardship. They thought one of the problems with the body is that it likes comfort and it likes pleasure. So one of the way we get the body out of its habit is by punishing it or by depriving it of the things that are comfortable or pleasurable. So you have all kinds of ascetic movements, people who eat less or nothing or just a handful or just, you know, the moon, as the moon waxes and wanes, they eat a little more every day and then a little less when the moon goes, this kind of thing. Or they, if in the heat of the day they go out and lie in the open, and in the damp and the cold of the night they go into the forest, so they go consciously against the grain. Or the Buddha's teaching has to be understood in the context, or the framing of his teaching has to be understood in a socio-cultural context. And compared to us, in the Buddha's day, there were a lot more ascetic practices going. So the Buddha, in many ways, was soft by proclaiming his middle way. Nowadays, the Buddha sounds rather more harsh. And much of his message encourages giving up, renunciation, disenchantment, dispassionateness. Yeah. Though we look at his teaching quasi from the other side than his own time has looked at his teaching. But the middle way is, and this is not a sort of slimy compromise. It is a razor sharp edge between non-indulgence, yeah, and self-mortification. We have types of punishing attitudes in our own minds. We don't call these particularly ascetic, but we can be quite unforgiving and unrelentless with ourselves. Modern people particularly, urbanized life is particular forms of self-mortification. I'm not just speaking of starvation diets and all the sacrifices human beings are willing to give for beautification or the eternal youthfulness or such like. There's also all kinds of self-punitive traits in the human mind. If we look at it a little bit more psychologically, asceticism takes a lot more individualist forms nowadays. You know, we stop ourselves from having pleasure, or even if we feel good, something in us goes off and says, you don't really deserve this. You know? Yeah? There's all kinds of psychological attitudes. And in many ways, these are more problematic than the religious ones, because the religious ones are out there. Everybody sees it, you know, this guy's only eating when the moon is waning, you know, waxing. If it is waning, he stops eating. Or this guy stands on his leg, or this guy lives in a heap of thorns or so. This is very obvious, clear. But the our own forms of asceticism and self-punishing or self-mortifying attitudes are a lot more private. You know, maybe we speak about those with our therapist, or our therapist tries to speak with us about them. Yeah. So we have to translate this aspect of the teaching.
But sometimes, you know, it's not self-punishment. We don't say we don't deserve it. We say after a while we don't need it anymore. You know?
Yeah, but that's something else.
Yeah.
That is not... we have then redefined our needs, isn't
yeah.
it? The giving up of greed and the giving up of need entails a distinction.
Yeah. But then we are
we are blamed for being ascetics, you know, which happened to us a lot, you know. People are blaming us for being ascetics, and we say, well, it's not like this. Our needs shrunk.
Well, you'd be blamed. You'd be blamed for practically everything. Yeah. You know, there's this wonderful saying somewhere in the Dhammapada where the Buddha says, this man comes to him and says, his name is Atula, and says, well, I'm blamed for, forgot what it is. He didn't speak. And then Buddha says, well, Atula, you know, you're blamed for speaking little, you're blamed for speaking much, you're blamed for not speaking. At the end of the day, you'll be blamed anyway. You know, if you try not to be blamed, you can't win. You know, so you are the only expert to decide what your needs are. And if you have come to the conclusion what your needs are, nobody else is anywhere near an expert to tell you. So I just stay unshakable in your choice and in what you know surely.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about this circle, you know, I was...
The Bardo circle.
Yeah, the Bardo circle. As it is not our... how do you say...
Discourse,
you know, in the Theravada.
Well, there's something very simple about it, I can do that without... There is a very elaborate teaching about the Bardas, as you may know, if you look at the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we'll speak in detail about this. But here, this just means that beings are rising according to their good deeds, according to their karma.
Who are rises?
Beings.
Beings, yes. Beings. You know, I can't say that they are living beings, but I can't say they're human beings, because some of them are not human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, beings are rising up through the various realms according to the good action they have lived by. And according to the good karma, the good action they have done, leads to good vipaka. And the fruition, vipaka, means that they are being reborn in better realms or in good realms. And on the other side, you have going down beings whose lives are not filled with wholesome karma, yeah, and who reap the results by going into the lower realms. Yeah. Basically, that's what it means. Yes, that's
okay. When we say lower realms, can you look at the human condition and say, for example, that in Africa where starvation, it's geographically, but starvation is a bad realm. It's like a different reality that we don't see. I don't know. What did the Buddha meant about it? Did you understand what I was
You were asking me what in a historical or in a contemporary perspective is an example of a lower realm. Is that what you're asking?
I was asking what did the Buddha meant when he say lower realm?
He meant a realm where suffering happens. Unmitigated suffering. Relentless suffering that is uninterrupted.
Endless suffering?
Not endless, because none of these states...
Continued?
Yeah.
Continued suffering? Yeah.
It's a suffering...
A
suffering that you cannot gain perspective. Mm-hmm. See, what privileges the human realm here is that although there is suffering and work and birth and death and things like that, human beings are capable of getting a perspective on suffering. They can reflect. They have choice. They can direct attention. They can train their hearts. They can train their minds. They can train their... they have various choices. In the hell realm, one of the things you do experience is you are not having choice. You know, it's Greek tragedy. You can't do it right, you know.
There is no
whatever you do,
reflect.
You're going
to
lose. Yeah?
Okay.
It's going to hurt, and you don't see an end to it. That's
good.
Choicelessness seems to be one of the major features. Pain, choicelessness, and that you do not experience the empowerment to actually act in ways that seem to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that seems to be. So obviously, there are many areas in contemporary world that manifest that. I always one of my personal images of a hell realm is a chicken factory. Yeah, it's a breeding chicken. You know, you're born in a cage and you die in that cage, and you'll never see anything else but a cage. And all you can do is produce eggs, and then at the end of it, you'll just kind of fall through the grate. Mm. Yeah. And as far as you can see, there's just chicken who are in the same condition, and you don't see where it comes from, and you don't see where it goes. This has always been an image, a very personal and private image of the hell realm.
So are the children in Africa with the bloated stomachs and in famine, are they like hungry ghosts?
I wouldn't think so.
No.
No.
No. Because I can imagine the animal, and I can even imagine the hell in relation to human beings. I don't need to imagine. We have collective memories of a hell of that nature, exactly like you described. But the hungry ghost is, unless when Itai asked about Africa, I immediately thought about these starving children in Africa, and I thought, but no, it's not. This is one of the realms that I find very difficult to imagine.
Let me give you a psychological equivalent. A hungry ghost realm is a realm of insatiable desire. You cannot possibly get enough. Symbolized by the big belly that is capable of producing incomprehensible hunger, and a tiny small mouth through which all the relief for that belly could come. So what that signifies is basically your capacity to expect, to long, to demand, to wish for is incomprehensibly bigger than the capacity to actually gratify this desire. Yeah?
Yes, you said that yesterday, and it was very clear yesterday, as it is today, what you just said. But I'm, and I can, you know, I can maybe, like maybe a neglected child might never be able to be satiated. You know, many children with severe neglect and infancy with neglect of mother love might never be able to compensate for it in the long run, but. I suppose this is just one of the realms that it's most difficult. I can understand the animal realm, I can understand the hell realm, but a collective image of that is more difficult.
It's the ghost realm. You know, if you look at for anything an equivalent in Western way of making things understood, it's the ghost realm. You know. You're haunting for centuries some poor family because they have done you some wrong, you know. And you just kind of chase down their whole dynasty by nocturnal appearances and scaring them out of their non-REM sleep, for example. Yeah. It's the ghost realm. In traditional Asian countries, pretas are ghosts, are dead people who are not resting, who have not either understood that they're dead or have died in a violent way, and who are displeased, and who come back, and who terrorize the living. You know, if you want to get that into sort of a mythological realm. If you allow me, I'd like to come back to some of the my point that the wheel, obviously the long-term solution is reducing ignorance, reducing avijja, reducing the not knowing condition at the beginning. And because any moment of experience that is accompanied by the opposite of ignorance, by understanding, by jnana or by vijja, means that this whole cycle up to vijnana sankhara, namarupa, salayatana, pasa vedana runs. Yeah? But then we don't get desire. We get exactly what Tor described, the acknowledgement that this is no longer needed. Yeah? It may be pleasant, but we don't actually crave. And it's crucial that we make this known to ourselves, how many things we know we don't need anymore. You know, we've all loved to play in the sandpit. And there's a time when you realize you're gradually getting too big. And there may be a moment when you actually longingly look back when you fit it in there, but somehow you realize it doesn't quite work anymore. And then there is a time you look at sandpits, and although you know you have actually greatly enjoyed and spent many hours in there, you somehow realize you don't want to go back in there. Yeah? And this is an acknowledgement of something that has been greatly pleasurable, that has been greatly nice to you, and you've spent much time, and you've pestered mommy to go there and wait and look after you, but now you don't go there anymore. You can look at sandpits without the desire to go and play in there. So many, this is a simple example, and so many things in our lives are like that. So, it doesn't mean that there are no sandpits. It doesn't mean that there are no other people who enjoy sandpits. You'll notice that the things you have given up or have grown out of don't seem to grow out of other people's experience. There is a sort of strange alienation by the fact we realize that we grow tired of things, or we grow dispassionate with things, but other people don't. And we can't quite take it serious anymore, or quite take them serious anymore. And we end up, in many ways, it feels a bit lonely sometimes, because one doesn't share. And much of our bonding is about sharing pleasure, isn't it? It's about eating and drinking and having a great time together and going places. And somehow, if the juice is out there, you're a little bit alone. And we try to pretend it's still fun and, you know, just to be part of it. And, you know, and it kind of gets tiresome after a while. And you realize, no, actually, the shoe doesn't fit anymore. So this is obviously the option. The ideal scenario is growing out of desire by understanding that any pursuit of desire only leads to a temporary gratification. And any temporary gratification of desire is followed by an even deeper longing. It is followed by a deeper habituation to gratification and to seeking and to desire and to looking how this can be gratified. Why would you want to have an ulcer? Because scratching the ulcer relieves your pain for a moment.
What's an ulcer?
It's a sore. Once you realize that gratification of desire only is a temporary solution, only gives you temporary reprieve or gratification, why would you want one? So, this is the ideal scenario, but obviously this needs some time. This is a long-term project. Please.
Is there a healthy desire and not healthy desire? I know there is not healthy desire. But is there
give me an example.
Any healthy desire?
Give me an example.
I thought maybe you would give me. I will give you I have one. I'm writing something now, and my desire is to complete it. To complete it. So this is a good desire? Is it a desire?
Yes.
Yes, it is. I believe it's a good desire. Unless I have maybe expectation that, you know, never mind, you
Well, I think a teaching that is very famous in this particular country says something about that you should recognize a tree by its fruit. So if the results of that desire are positive results, then you decide. If the results of that desire lead to more desire, then it wasn't a good desire. But in any case, you will pay the price, you see? You will get the bill. If you renounce to that desire, you will have to live with the pain of not having fulfilled it. If you try to fulfill that desire, you will have to put in the effort, the time, the money, the energy, the impatience, the learning to fulfill that desire. You will get the bill anyway. You decide whether this desire is useful one or not. You know, we have to pay the price anyway. We are responsible. Nobody else is going to do that for us. Now, for some things, we may decide that we actually want to do this. We want to fight. We want to struggle. We want to compete. We want to attain. And for other things, we say, no, the price is too high. It doesn't work. It cost me too much. I'm too old for this. Or I've done it 15 times and I'm not going to do it anymore. Important is that you make the addition. You look. This is what it costs me. This is what it gives me. If you decide there is more pain, then you probably won't do it. If you decide it holds more promise, then you may be likely to do it. Now, only if we're very honest with us what we get out of things, we can actually make this bill. And we will not give up things that look good to us unless we have made very, very honestly the bill. The Buddha says there's only this five things you need to think of. One is that things arise. One is that things cease. One is what we get out of something. Yeah? The asada, what we actually receive as gratification. The other one is the default, what it actually costs us, the disadvantage of this, the adinava. And only when we actually have made the bill and we have concluded honestly, soberly, not for other people, not for the church or the synagogue or for the Buddhist temple or for the Buddhist monk or the teacher, but for ourselves, only if we've made the bill and decided that the pain is more than what we get back, only then are we likely to give up. Yeah. So this is for most of us a long-term process, and it's a very individual process. What we have here, if there is no blindness at work, then we experience all this. The birds will continue to whistle. Yeah. The sandpits will continue to be there. The pub will continue to be open. But we don't feel the pull. We don't feel... There is passa, but the Vedana doesn't go out. It's not liking or not liking. Or even if it's nice, we don't attach to it. You know, we don't grasp after it. We don't long for it. That's the ideal scenario. Most of the time we don't have the ideal scenario. Most of the time if we practice, in fact practice is never ideal, just to be honest. If you're always experiencing ideal situation, it means you're not practicing. Yeah, it means you're just gratifying your desires. If you're actually not feeling the resistance of your desires, it means you actually don't swim against the stream. It means you just go with the flow. Yeah. So, if you feel you can break this wheel here, at the point of passa, can avoid, vedana, that you enjoy or don't enjoy certain things, you cannot avoid. In Buddhist psychology, this is due to vipaka. It's due to previous action. You don't have a choice. The only choice you have is about acknowledging this or not acknowledging this. If you decide to repress, you have to repress very early. It's a lot easier to repress something when you don't feel it. When you do feel it and you like it and you have to repress the desire, it's a lot more work. So one way of repressing is not feeling it. Yeah. Not being there. You know that from child psychology, if a need is continually not met, then the child will refuse the need. If mommy is never there, the child will stop crying, and even if mommy comes back, it doesn't actually want to see mommy. It pretends it's not interested. It refuses to acknowledge, because the self decides that it is better for me to cut myself off that need, for me to make this decision, than for mommy to make the decision. Yeah. So if you want to repress, really, you have to repress not just the desire, you have to repress actually the pleasantness of the previous experience. Yeah. So most of us do experience, we do have contact, we do develop pleasure and displeasure, and then we have to live with the degree of aversion or with the degree of longing or desire. And if we are prepared to allow these feelings of longing or pushing away, if we allow these feelings coexistence, if we allow ourselves to feel this without acting on them, then there is transformation possible. At that moment, the heart starts to transform itself. But most of the time, we don't want. We have a feeling of desire, we want to fulfill it. So we don't wait, and we don't want to feel the desire, we want to feel the fulfilling of the desire. We don't want to feel the pushing away, the aversion, we want it to stop. Yeah. So it's noisy, we go and close the window. Or we're hungry, we go and eat something. You understand? So the willingness to actually be with things without lunging into action, either of hatred type or of greed type, this willingness to be there and bear the experience is what is the first step of transforming the experience. So if we can't get out here by getting out of avidya, we can sometimes get out after vedana. We feel things are nice or not nice, but we don't develop desire. If we have practiced, or if we have some insight, then this is possible. We feel the vedana, but it doesn't turn into desire or into aversion. This is ideal, yeah? When you sit still, you meditate, and things arise, and you realize you really have space. It's a pleasant thought, and it's just that. It doesn't breed young. It doesn't go into a thousand pleasant thoughts. Just this. A pleasant sound, a pleasant taste. This is wonderful. This is what sati does. This is what mindfulness does. It allows us to be with something as it is, without proliferation, without developing into greed or into aversion. Ideal scenario. At a later stage, if it's less ideal, the mind actually has already some arising of aversion if the sensation is unpleasant, or it has some sensation of greed or desire or longing or wishing coming in, then we have the choice of not acting. Imagine you're producing, when you meditate, an alchemical vessel. A vessel in which you allow all things to come in. And the vessel has very thick walls. And because the walls are thick, you can allow the process to smolder. You can allow the things to ferment. You give yourself the permission to sit still. And in that stillness of heart, you have made the decision that you are not going to act on all impulses in your heart. You're not going to act on your thoughts, on your wishes, on your desires, but you are willing to feel them. You invite them in. So you sit there, and because the walls of your vessel are strong, you are not going to break out. They can actually come in, they can show themselves, and they change. Only when they are received into your heart, they actually change. It's as simple. Only when you think, when you love things as they are they going to become different? If you're not willing to love them as they are, if you say, first you change, then I love you, it's not going to happen. Yeah. The same you do when you meditate. You allow these things. First you stabilize the mind. You center the mind. You make it still. And after a while, all the things you have decided before that were obstacles, were meditation hindrances, all these things, you open up and you look at them. You let them come. Because you know now your samadhi is strong enough, your sila is strong enough, you can transform these things by looking at them soberly, quietly, with great clarity. This is what is happening when we decide to stay still, rather than run with the monkey who grasps, or the woman who grasps after the fruit. We stay still, we feel the wish for the fruit, and we don't go after the fruit. Most of the time, meditation practice is that. We acknowledge our tendencies of not wanting, aversion, of hatred, of wanting, wishing, longing, desire. And we are giving ourselves permission to feel this. And often that feels not pleasant. You know, if you think meditation is only good if it feels good, then I have to disappoint you. This is again something we don't write on the brochure because people like to feel good and people think they have good meditation if it feels good, but in fact meditation often works best if it doesn't feel good. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that burning Toy speaks of is the transformation. You know, that's the alchemical transformation that takes place. That purifies the heart. So please, if you walk out here in half an hour and if you forget everything I've talked about, please do not forget three things. Optimum scenario, reducing ignorance. The most basic commitment Buddhists make is trying to understand things at the deepest most level. What makes human beings free from desire and from hatred, what lets human beings live compassionately and with loving kindness and with insight, is the willingness to understand what's happening. The willingness to say, the movie I'm in is the right movie. I'm not running away. It may not be my favorite story, but I have good reasons, obviously, to be here. I am looking more closely. Even if it hurts, even if I feel frustrated, I am willing to look what's happening. That's the first step. That's the way to reduce avijja. Avijja lives of the fact that we don't want to know.
What is avijja?
Ignorance. The next step, if we are taken in by the wheel, we try to see whether it's possible to widen the gap between liking something and disliking something and wishing it to go on or wishing it to go away. Is there a gap between these things? Is there, you know, you can really practice that. You know, you wash up your dishes and you dunk your hands in the hot water and you realize this is pleasant. Dunking your hands in hot water is pleasant. And you realize, actually, I would like to have my hands in there. Yeah? Very simple little example. You take conscious note of liking and disliking. That's what we do in meditation retreats. First couple of days, we still the mind. We do body sweeping or mindful anapanasati or kaya satipatthana exercise. And then we start to notice vedana. Not just while we meditate, but everywhere. We notice that moment when the mind makes bing. Yeah. Oh, this is nice. Or no. Yes? No. Yeah. This is so fast. And we learn to note these moments. Because this little moment decides, A, where our attention goes, and B, it gives rise, obviously, to the tendencies to get rid of things, push away, not being interested, aversive tendencies, or it gives rise to wanting, grasping, taking hold of things. And if we can separate that first little moment, if we can widen the gap between liking something and wishing for it, that's very, very useful. We can study that. We don't need to meditate that. Meditation helps, but there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do this. Notice that in your sense bases. If something pleasant happens, notice whether it has to do with bodily experience, what you hear, smell, taste, touch, or if it has to do with mental experience, what you remember, what you fantasize, what you think of.
The wish to change, to have or not to have, to change body posture or change or take more, this is what you mean?
I'd like you to acknowledge what is just before that. The pain in your current body posture, the unpleasantness, this is the vedana. And this gives rise to the impulse to change the posture.
The moment of it happens, the not satisfaction from the body posture?
Exactly. To distinguish that from the impulse to change it. You see, most of the time what happens here, Patichasamapada makes Bhavajati, pang. Bhavajati suffering, pang. Bhavajati suffering, pang. Yeah, we don't actually get the initial stages. You definitely don't get avidya. You don't get sankhara. You don't get vijnana. You don't get namarupa, salayatana, pasa. You may get, if you're really sharp, you may get contact. And then vedana, yes, nice. And then, yes, yeah, right. But generally, you don't distinguish the sequence, yeah? And because this...
Yeah, just says when you fall from a tree.
Yeah.
You just feel the...
Oh, exactly. Mm. He spoke about Abhidhamma there, yeah? Rather than counting the branches, yeah. you just hit the thud, feel the thud. So one of the things we do is we try to identify some of the stages. And the stages you can identify most clearly is vedana. It's liking or not liking. But usually we don't even feel that. All we feel is, I want. Yeah. But the fact that you liked something before you wanted it, you have not noticed. So we establish the distinction between pleasant experience, and obviously we try to widen the gap. There's nothing wrong with pleasant experience. But there is a definite tendency that the things we find pleasant incite desire in our heart, or wish. You know, sometimes this is very gentle. You know, it's just a kind of delicate little interest. You know, it's not always livid, enraged, sort of rapaciousness or so. It's gentle. It's harmless. It's not immoral. You know, we have to think of these things as not in moral terms, but in psychological terms. Otherwise, we're never gonna. We have to identify. This is insidious. This is happening all the time. And once we establish the difference between vedana and tanha, then we have actually more choice. You know, we can say where we are, what's happening. We can orient. One of the first tasks about this thing is we learn to orient in our experience better. We learn to inhabit these five khandhas better. And with better orientation, we have more choices. We know when things are lost. We know where to look for. Yeah. So, distinguishing vedana from desire, and then, if this doesn't work, if we've missed that opportunity, there's another opportunity. We have the chance to actually bear with desire. We have the chance to hang in, rather than enact, rather than engage that desire, trying to immediately gratify it, or the aversion, enact our aversion, push away what is unpleasant, move it out, go away from it, split off, either by distraction or by repressive activity or by simply turning away our attention, then we are willing to bear this. So you sit here and you have pain in your knee, yeah? And the guy doesn't ring the bell in front. You can do all kinds of things. You can think, well, probably my kneecap, yeah? It's probably going to pop off any minute. I've always thought this Buddhism was a bit strange. You know, it's joint wrecking, fanatism. You know, what does he feel? He probably doesn't have knees, or he's probably got already steel kneecaps from there. No wonder he doesn't feel anything. Yeah, you can. Then you can really seethe with that thought. Yeah, you can really be smouldering. And what is happening is probably that it's going to hurt more. Or you can sit there and say, out with your pain. I don't want, and there's no pain in my meditation. This is not happening. What is happening now is not happening to me. Not again, you know, out with you. And it's very likely that your pain will start really, really glow, yeah? And it's going from a silent, embery glow to really flaring flames. It's going to really shoot up and it's going to lick up your leg, yeah? And the more you hate that, and the more you want it to stop, and the more you want to move it out, yeah, the more it's going to take hold of your body, and you're really going to be in flames.
You know, sometimes we're asked, you know, why don't we go by the so-called Zen tradition? When you are hungry, you eat. When you are tired, you sleep. And then I always smile, you know, that you must do the whole range of things, the whole thing, to come to a point in which you know when you're hungry, when it is a need, or when you know you're hungry. You're not taken away by hunger or something like that. But sometimes people ask us, why do we go against the stream?
Mm.
No, it's we come across every time with these questions, and we have to push the water down, you know, to calm them.
Because of the crocodiles down there in the pool.
Yeah.
That's why you go on the stream.
I think that that's a very romanticized version
exactly.
of the Zen teaching.
Exactly.
The Zen teaching I have had experience with is not.
Of course.
You know, this is great if you're enlightened.
Yeah.
When hungry, eat. This is great if you're enlightened. But
as long as
you can't distinguish greed from need, obviously you need to go against the stream to distinguish them, isn't it?
Yeah.
The learning process is you have to meet resistance.
Yeah.
You know, this is obvious. So let me quickly sum up. The major part of our practice will be struggling against the impulse to gratify what we desire, or the impulse to engage with aversion, to act on aversion. Now, to go back to the example with the knee, if you allow that pain to be there, that pain is likely to cause less problems. If your attitude towards an unpleasant experience is one of non-conflict with it, then it still may be painful, but it may be a lot less painful than it is when you fight with it. If you have any experience with that sort of thing, you will notice that things at least halve by intensity if you manage to take out the aversion or the aggressiveness against it. You can verify that in every domain of your life. Most of our times we struggle not just with the things as they are, but we struggle with our resistance against the things as they are. That's the bigger struggle. It is the truth in physical experience. It's the truth if you practice any body work. You know, if you do a martial art, or if you do yoga exercises, if you do your forward bends and you feel only the resistance of your muscles and of your tendons, then this is probably easier to bear than if you feel the resistance of your mind against your stiff muscles. Yeah? You will notice it'll get softer as soon as you get out of the resistance against it. And that's the same with our life. So the first thing is we try to be non-conflictive. Even possible, have loving kindness, not just for other people, but for the pain in my knee. And then we try to go underneath the label. One of the problems with pain in my knee is the fact that I have given it the label pain, and pain is bad, and I don't want pain. Yeah, this is already in my Sanya program. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can say actually what exactly is happening, yeah, let's leave the pain aside. Is this more a tingling or a hammering or a pulsing or a throbbing or a creeping sort of experience? Is it more on the inside or on the outside? Yeah. It becomes a phenomenon, and as a phenomenon, it becomes suddenly possible to investigate this. Once we are capable of going underneath the label, we're actually dealing with phenomenal experience. Now, phenomenal experience is observable. Yeah, we can actually get quite concentrated on pain sometimes. Yeah, there's a type of pain that cuts through all distraction. Because you know, if you're going to be distracting yourself now, the thing is going to grow on you. And maybe if you go to it deliberately and stay with it, you know, very gently, not pushing, gently, gently, gently be with it, it may be just able to bear it. Yeah? And suddenly you find that the mind is actually quite calm. And although you don't like pain, and although pain is unpleasant, it is actually quite fascinating that it's possible to gain clarity and stillness on the basis of an object that in itself is not attractive, that is not pleasant. At the same time, you may realize that while dunking your hands in hot water and washing up is intrinsically a pleasant experience, but you hate washing up because other people have a washing machine and I don't, and I waste time, you may find that even though the experience of dunking your hand in the hot water is pleasant, the concept of washing up is highly unpleasant, and you waste your life on washing up. Yeah? You come to complete opposite conclusion. While the intrinsic appearance is pleasant, the whole of it, the way you have framed it, is unpleasant. So the mind has many, many tricks, and important is that you go underneath the conceptual level and deal with actual phenomena. With this, you can get insight in what motivates you. Obviously, the heart has wishes and longings. And yes, the lady who asked me whether there is positive desire, yeah, there is positive desire. Buddhists don't call it desire, they call it aspiration. Yeah? They call it the wish to, they call it bodhicitta, or they call it the wish for liberation, or such like.
One fortunate attachment.
Yes, bodhicitta, yeah, exactly. So much for this. Then I would like to have a quick word on the criticized three-lifetime version, because I don't want to not tell you about this. The three-lifetime version assumes that the first two steps, avijja, paccaya, sankhara, those two links are happening in the past life. Yeah. So through past ignorance, past karmic activity has taken place. This karmic activity leads, this is in the next life, the present life, to vijnana. Vijnana is the arising consciousness in this type of explanation, and it means the first setting in motion of this conscious experience, of this being. Yeah. Then you have... So the result of previous ignorance is previous karmic activity. Previous karmic activity has as a result vijnana. The fruition of that karmic activity in a previous life is this particular body, is this particular mind, is this particular circumstances. I end up being born in a world that has some resemblance or has some causal connection with the type of activity I have had in my previous life. Yeah? I'm being born. If I behave like a pig, I will end up amongst the pigs, to put it crudely. Yeah? If I live like a god with divine meditative states and lofty aspirations, I may end up in a more lofty, light, flooded surrounding, yeah? To be very simplistic here. So the three-lifetime version operates by a model that the third link, called vijnana, is the first arising of consciousness in this life. So with vijnana, namarupa, salayatana, I generate a physical, psychophysical organism, I generate sense bases, and I end up being contacted again. Yeah. So the contact gives rise to pleasant and unpleasant feelings, and unpleasant feelings and pleasant feelings give rise to desire and aversion. Then I have the usual choice. I can act on this aversion or I cannot act on this aversion. And up to bhava, things are in this lifetime. And then jati is the next life. You know, the physical, the birth here, the analogy of birth is taken as the literal birth in the third lifetime, and the third lifetime, obviously, the shorthand version goes to what is born will have to die, goes to old age, sickness, and death, or dukkha, basically. Yeah. So this is what the three-lifetime version says. But the only interesting thing, I do, in fact, think that this is truly the case, this happens. Yeah, this is one valid interpretation of Paticca-samuppada, but it doesn't make much of this cycle in our current contemplative undertaking. It's a not very contemplative tool. It just explains how things are as they are. The interesting thing about it is that it very clearly points out that up till the point of passa, of contact, we don't really have much say. The fact that we enjoy what we enjoy and hate what we hate is due to previous action. Yeah. if you want it in terms of kamma vipaka, what we do is kamma. The quality that determines kamma is the quality of our wholesome or our unwholesome intention. The Buddha says very clearly, what he calls kamma is intention. Yeah. Kamma is not destiny, it's not kismet, it's not... Kamma is action, it means doing or working or acting. So there's a very common misunderstanding in the West to refer to the fruit of such action with the term kamma. In Buddhist psychology, this is called vipaka. This means fruition. It's the result. So it only really makes sense to speak about kamma if we're willing to separate this into the part that has to do with what we're actually doing based on our intention and the resultant part of that, which in Buddhist psychology is called vipaka, fruition. Now, up till Vedana, really, it's all fruition. We don't really have a choice whether we like what we like or we don't like what we like, what we don't like. Yeah? We don't really have much choice in this. All this is vipaka. Our choice and our karmic responsibility starts afterwards. It starts where we affirm desire or aversion, where we start enacting desire or aversion. With that type of activity, our intention kicks in. And with the intention, we become karmically active. We become karmically responsible. So this is crucial to understand that up to Passavedana, all this is vipaka. It's due to previous experience. And whether you like Bartok string quartets or the Rolling Stones, it's basically not so much to do with choice, but it has to do with your... This is vipaka. You're all the brother listening to the Stones, so you're probably exposed to a lot more Stones than Bartok string quartets, so they will sound dissonant. And you may like the Stones. And once you realize that there is not just the Stones, but there's also Bartok, you may actually consciously start to listen to Bartok and begin to appreciate it. Yeah? So the vipaka of this growing appreciation is that you will like it, because you learn to discern things. The things you deal with become more differentiated. They become more alive. What you give your attention to comes alive. Yeah. It's an old story. Where the attention goes, the energy goes. The things you give your energy to, they become more alive. They become more... You begin to love it, basically. Karmically crucial is the decision to act on desire. It's not that you have desire, but it's what you do with desire or aversion. This becomes karmically crucial. This is what then either continues this wheel or it leads to the lessening of speed of the wheel, or it fades a little bit. Yeah? Am I clear with this? Yeah? One very interesting little sequence of Paticca-samuppada is to be found in the gradual sayings, in the sayings on causation, which is where most of the texts are on dependent origination, and it occurs only one single time, and it's very unusual. It has a loop that starts here with avijja, blindness, and go through the usual loop. What it does at the end, instead of old age, sickness and death, birth, lamentation, grief and despair, it has the term dukkha. It just says suffering. And then, instead of going back into avijja, it goes into something else called faith. And that's something I'd like to say about it. One response to suffering, one possible response is faith. Rather than blaming, looking for culprits, resenting, it is possible that we become deliberate or voluntarily suffering beings. And in that willingness to actually be with something, to acknowledge the universal nature of suffering, not just that suffering happens personally to us, but that something in what we interpret as being a personal insult to our happiness is intrinsic in human experience, gives rise to faith. It allows us to put a big picture on our own personal experience, and that is liable to give rise to faith. We start having a type of faith in a teaching that tells us about this, that puts what happens to us in perspective. This interesting form of paticca-samuppada continues from faith, it goes to pamoja, which means a gladness of heart. You know, because we understand something of the significance of pain. And you have to acknowledge what most people takes to a religious experience is some kind of crisis, some kind of suffering. It's not just a suffering that happens secretly, but something that we acknowledge we need help. Something is not good here, something in a big way. And I'd like to understand this. And that makes us turn to things that put a perspective on our experience, that are willing to look for a bigger picture than just me against the world. That little change alters the whole sequence here. So from faith, which empowers, in Buddhism, faith is a cardinal virtue. It empowers us to actually take on action. It empowers us to be with things. It empowers us to open up. Even if we are not capable of immediately understanding, it allows us to actually be with confusion, with things that are uncertain.
How come that faith is coming from, suffering? The knowing that suffering is universal.
Imagine this morning we spoke of Kisa Gotami, who lost her child. Yeah? And although the Buddha didn't make her child alive, Kisa Gotami was asked to go from house to house and look for a mustard seed, for a medicine, a fictitional medicine, that was made of mustard seeds from houses where nobody had died. And obviously she couldn't find that, because in all the houses somebody had died. And by the end of her round, she realized that what had happened was not just a personal experience. It was a universal experience. It was something that she couldn't help but be part of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the same way, once we understand that suffering is not just a personal insult, mm-hmm. but has something to do with the fundamental condition mm-hmm. of being a human being, once we let that in, we stop investing in our defense system against this truth, we gain faith in a teaching that speaks of this, in a teaching that offers a solution.
It's coming back to the first book.
Yes, exactly.
Understanding.
You see, you do acknowledge suffering not just as a personal problem, but you realize that being a human being means you are liable to suffer, because suffering is an existential experience.
It's not just that, if I may add.
Please.
To that question. If you suffered, and you suffered really deeply, and there is the only way either to die for the suffering or to die altogether, then you must jump to a faith, to a certain faith, because otherwise the world couldn't go with you. I mean, but your suffering has to be, from my experience, really so deep that you say, either I die because I can't go on living, or I die to my wrong living, to my wrong ideas, to myself. In brackets. That's it. That's how I experienced it. That's how I came to the way. So, mm-hmm. faith is the only way. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can I put that very crudely? Look, your options are basically to do something that you know very well and that you know brings pain. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the other option is to do something you don't know mm-hmm. what is going to turn out, but it at least holds a certain degree of hope or the mm-hmm. possibility that something else may happen, because mm-hmm. that which you know and you have exercised so many times is very predictable in its unsatisfactory result. This is the most elementary form of faith. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a risk. You cannot prove it. You have no guarantees. It may also turn out to be pain, but yet you take exactly as Thor said, you take the leap. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And out of that initial faith comes a sort of gladness, joy. So the paticca-samuppada, which is called Upanisa Sutta, goes on, and instead of going back into sankhara vijnana namarupa, it goes into from faith to a gladness of mind. Capacity, the mind is lifted up. Suddenly you have a bigger perspective. Clear image. You go into, you've ever gone to a big Gothic cathedral. You know, Gothic understanding of mind and God was, you could only praise God by elevating the mind up. Yeah, so everything in Gothic architecture makes takes you up. You go in there and you're a Buddhist or a Jew. It doesn't work. Doesn't matter. You know,
it works.
It works. Does this to you? Yeah. So, what happens is, in that movement of faith, something takes the mind up. Yeah. Certainly, a shaft of light comes in. So a possibility seems to open up. With that joy, something else happens. There's an energy coming into your body. If you're a meditator, you will know that very well. One of the passages in the Satipatthana Sutta says that the mind has to be gladdened. You know, one of the ways to make a mind collected and concentrated is to make it happy. A sad mind never concentrates. An angry mind never concentrates. It's only a glad mind. A mind that experiences some degree of pleasantness, and a gladness is uplifted. Yeah. So after that, you have a type of energy which in Buddhist teaching is called piti, which means it's a type of rapture or delight. It's a bit undisquiet, but it's very, it's a fizzy. It's a fizzy kind of energy. So you go from faith to joy to piti, and then you go to happiness. Happiness is the fizzy, but without the bubbles. It's calm. And then you go to stillness of mind. Now, and if you look at the sequence of these terms, it's obvious that we speak of meditative states. Yeah. And at first, faith makes you sit down. You trust that you're not going to go mad by sitting down and closing your eyes and sitting with yourself for half an hour. You know, once you do that, you realize a space opens up. There is more space than you thought. This makes you glad. You stay with this and you find there's some kind of energy coming up your spine. Something tingles, yeah? It's possible
your
to access
spine, you said?
Your spine, yeah? That's an example. I'm talking of my own story. Yeah?
Okay, yeah.
So something's happening, you know? Your chest is opening out. And then this energy, this piti energy comes in. And after that, it settles. It reaches a sort of plateau. You come to a degree of stillness. Then the mind starts to collect. Pasadi, it means smooth. Yeah, it's a smooth, watery surface. And then the mind really becomes quiet. Then the kind of inner stillness of the sea starts to open out. And with that stillness, things come into perspective. Yeah, it's like after a rainy day. I'm not sure how it is here. Rain is a bad example in Israel.
No, I can't remember.
Because you probably don't remember. Where I come from, we have a particular type of wind that clears the atmosphere, that takes all the dust out. And then it rains. And after the rain, everything seems to be closer. Yeah, the mountains suddenly are closer up because the vision is better. The dust and the air has gone out. Yeah, this is what happens when you have collectedness of mind and the mind concentrate. Initially, the things are still there. There's still slight mental activity. There is still slight thought. But suddenly, everything seems spacious. Yeah, you have plenty of time. Thoughts come slowly. Yeah, and they don't bite anymore. You know, they don't kind of up at your face. They kind of, they just kind of cross. Mm-hmm. You realize they don't pull you away. And they don't rip you out of the saddle anymore. You're just there cruising, settling, still breathing. Yeah? The breath becomes one big thing, one round. You know, the in-breath and the out-breath seem to merge. Yeah? So this is samadhi. We have faith, we have joy, we have piti, we have sukha, pasadi, and then we have samadhi. And in the samadhi, suddenly the vision clears. We see. Things are decked out. We have a perspective. In this perspective, this is what the Buddha calls jnana. He says, you know, we understand. Not because we think, but we actually see. You know, it's there. It has taken a gestalt. It's there right in front of us, decked out. The lay of the land is obvious. We know what's a hill, we know what's a forest. And this is the type of knowledge or knowing that is liberating. We are no longer troubled.
Then your perspective on things changes. If you see things like, well, you say you see better in this kind of state.
Yes. Yes. It's a calmness that informs your seeing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine like you're on a mountain. You know, you walk up and you see folds of mountains and trees and forests and slopes and hills and roads. And then after a certain elevation, you see above everything.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of unfolded. It's lying there, decked out, draped in front of you. You can see it. And you know, you can see. You can see this river goes there, that forest ends there, this slope is merging into this slope. Yeah?
Mm.
This is a type of knowing that the Buddha says is liberating. In our little sequence, it's called jnana. Yeah? It's jnana or yatha bhuta jnana dasana. We see things as they truly are. Yeah, so you have to imagine this does this kind of this loop, yeah? And then after the jnana comes, because you know, because you see things, you grow disenchanted. The heart is no longer pulled in, you know, it's no longer reeled in, yeah? You become not weary, but it just loses its pull. It loses its attraction. It loses its repulsive nature. You see things for what they are. You are completely cognizant of these things, but you're no longer effectively pulled or pushed away by things. The next stage in this little sequence is called viraga, which means literally going out of color. It's fading. After the pull has stopped, which suddenly the passions go down. You know, you sense, and this is no longer something that is subjectively or objectively. It's something you cannot separate anymore. You just notice that the degree of passion goes down. And then the next stage is, it's called cooling down. It's called nibbida. It means everything becomes not just cognitively quiet, but also your heart becomes imperturbable.
Yeah.
You're no longer pulled away. You know there are no longer storms awaiting you around the corner. You can no longer be dragged around by your heart. And then you have vimutti. It's called liberation. And then you know that you're liberated. So
this is the sequence.
This is the sequence here. No, this is not the description of jhana. You see, jhanas are just meditative absorptions. They're not necessarily make you free. They make the mind still and they make the mind happy. But they not necessarily make the mind free. If they do so only temporarily, as long as you meditate. But here we're not speaking of a specific state. We are speaking of an existential process, something that is lasting. If you're freed, then you're supposed to remain free. Now, jhanic experience will give you a very quiet mind, it will give you a very blissful mind, and it will give you some of that perspective I spoke about. But it's not necessarily going to give you a permanent freedom. It gives you freedom as long as you're in that jhanic state, but then you come back out of the jhanic state and it continues. Now, chances are that if you have the gift to jhanic practices, then obviously the mind will become more calm, because some of that stillness lasts. Yeah? One of the things that happens in meditation, you dampen your meditative obstacles. Your nivaranas go back. They become more quiet. And even though you come out of the meditative state, the obstacles don't snap back up into action. They take a while till they come back. Yeah? So in those times, you have very good vision. You have a very good understanding. You can reflect very deeply. Obviously, in a jhanic state, you cannot reflect. That's the great disadvantage of jhanic state.
You cannot?
No, they're absorptions. You do not have reflective ability in there. Yeah. So there is not something you can understand in there. They are deeply healing experiences, but they're not something that is intrinsically liberating. You need the calm on the way to the jhana or on the way out from the jhana. You need that calm to lay flat the obstacles, to clear the vision. But the jhana in itself doesn't actually engender liberation, only a temporary one.
But when you come out of the jhanic state, then you can reflect.
Yeah. So our little transcendent dependent arising goes from disenchantment, which is the stage before dispassionateness, and then comes cooling down, complete cooling down, and then comes liberation. You realize that you are no longer manipulated by the objects and the content of your experience. And then the cherry on the cake is that you know that all this has happened. Yeah, you have the asavakaya jnana, you have the knowledge that all your influxes are destroyed, that you're no longer liable to the pollutions of the heart, you're no longer liable to be troubled, you're no longer liable to be obscured. And I would like to say that this is, although it is a single example of a paticca-samuppada that leads out, that leads back from pain, and it's interesting, the switching point is the pain and our attitude to pain. It leads out in a meditative sequence to stillness, to dispassion, to liberation, and to the knowledge of liberation. So we are, the last stage is when you actually are conscious of the dynamic of your process.
But is it also a ring?
It's also
all the stages.
It's also a ring.
Are the stages conditioned?
Yes.
Is the vimutti conditioned?
Yeah, the vimutti is conditioned by everything that went on beforehand. The vimutti is conditioned by this passion, by
all the stages are conditioned in this ring also.
Yes, yes. In fact, they are described as that. They are. This is a veritable example of a positive round of dependent origination. Mm-hmm. Dependent origination that is not propelled by ignorance.
So they're also impermanent. I mean, you can have, you can be disenchanted, and then dispassionate.
And then be fascinated again.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a question.
Well, like this model here, like the normal paticca-samuppada, it is a structural model. Yeah. It maps a pattern of possible conditional relations out of suffering. But it does so as a structural pattern. It says, if you're going to go out there, these are possible stages you can take. And any of these stages rests on the other. Yeah. You can't just go from suffering to samadhi. You need to be able to transform the heart so that it is glad. And if you want to transform suffering into gladness, you need faith. Yeah? So faith is the condition on which samadhi or joy depends. Yeah? Mm. You understand?
Yes,
the way these things rest.
Understand with the first stages, but then I don't really can say that I experience oscillation between disenchantment and fascination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's more or less one way. I mean, there are relapses,
mm-hmm.
let's say, but it goes one way. It's not a ring. Disenchantment I have today, I'm not expecting it to vanish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's something like, it's not really an attainment, but it's as if it's one way.
Yes, look, we look at this as the biography of one event. Yeah?
The transcendental one, you mean?
Both of them. They're one event. Yeah. Now, obviously, the more of those events that go in this way, the more of your experiences will be colored by this pattern or by the transcendent pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you manage to, in this particular aspect of suffering, transform this into faith, mm-hmm. faith to joy, from joy to piti, vipassati to sukha, mm-hmm. to samadhi, to nibbida, viraga, nirodha, finally to vimutti, you're very likely, once you have established this pattern, you know, you will know how to go that way with other events of your experience, with other aspects of your experience. And although these are individual biographies or individual events happening, they do establish a basic pattern, and that basic pattern has a tendency to repeat itself. If your response is stubborn ignorance to pain, then you will probably get more and more of that happening. And the other way around, if you manage to transform your suffering into a faithful, or gain out of that a faithful attitude, this will strengthen. Every time you run this, it's like neurons, you know, you build synapses.
Yeah,
you strengthen this particular conduit. Mm-hmm. And
it's not a cord. You're
right.
Talking about the threads, and the threads that bit by bit they
think of neural connections.
I,
you know,
I felt it. I
yeah,
don't
yeah.
have to think about it.
Then there's
yeah.
an element of addiction either way.
Yeah, I'm perfectly happy with that. I'm all in favor of that type of addiction. Good. I have failed you on the last half an hour of meditation, I promised. We are already running over time. I just would like to take stock for a moment and see whether something is left unbearably hanging in the vague that I could clear up.
When do you come again?
Soon. Can I ask you a personal question?
Good, if it's not too personal.
I'll try, you can say it's too personal. I understand that you left the ministry, and now you are living like us, and you are in a relationship.
Yes.
And my question is, when you fell in love, were you calm? Like you were, I'm sorry if it's too personal, but I just wanted to understand as a Buddhist, you know, after so many years, when in the relationship, when you know you are calm and you have a happy mind and nothing.
I get you.
You're not afraid to lose it.
I get you. Well, I have to disappoint you. I wasn't calm in the first place, you know, just because I was wearing a Buddhist robe, I wasn't always calm. So I can tell you that my life, while I was a Buddhist monk, has been a mixture of happiness and suffering, and some moments have been inspiring and enlightened, and other moments have been rather encumbered and dark. And I have had a very fine time. And I suspect my life will continue on the same vein. It will be a mixture of things.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. Good.
Yes, because I practice, and you know, I want to see how someone who practiced so many years, you know, felt. That's all.
I can assure you that this practice is not just for monks and nuns. And while there are many advantages to a monastic life, monastic life is by no means the exclusive place for good practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd like you to be assured
mm-hmm.
of that.
Okay.
And I have not left the ministry. I'm still in the ministry. I have changed my uniform, but this is still the ministry. I have not gone away from the
mm-hmm.
Buddhist teaching.
Okay.
Please.
But I'm still curious about the developmental process in the point of view of the Buddhism. And if I say something about it, as I understood it, that maybe, because I'm a clinical psychologist, and it's interesting, it is also from the professional point of view. about the psychological point of psychological needs. That I understood it as that you have to be satisfied with the psychological needs enough to give it up later, something like that.
Yeah, this is a big story. I think you have to look the Buddhist teaching, what he actually speaks of. He rarely speaks of something that we would name a developmental approach. He seems to give a fairly broad spectrum teaching. And if I look at the preconditions that are not stated in the Buddhist teaching, I have to say, then I would think somebody has to be reasonably healthy to make good use of that. I can speculate why that is the case. I can say extended family in northern India, 5th century BC, worked better than a nuclear family in, you know, 21st century AD or something like that. This is totally speculative. I don't know. If I look at the Buddhist teaching, the explicit teaching, there is very little which makes use of developmental models.
And implicit?
This, for example, I think in some ways is a developmental model here. Mm. You know, it says before your mind actually gets collected, it has to be able to have joy. Mm. Before it has joy, it has to be able to actually get energy. It needs some juice to get going. Mm. Before you have the capacity to give energy to empower the mind, you have to have some faith. Before you have faith, generally something bad needs to happen to you. You need some crisis that gets you out of your normal self mode, you know, that gives you a knock or two. And then you're realizing that, hey, something big is happening. It's not just me and my little number here. Yeah? So you could say this is a developmental model. But if I look at how he taught his monks, for example, then his teaching to monks was broad. How he treated monks, and there we come to the implicit model, you could see that some people, he said, you stay with him. Yeah? You don't go away. The Buddha said, I praise emptiness, I praise solitariness, go and seek solitude, there are these trees, meditate, monks. Yeah? And then he also said, it's crucial that you stay in community, that you have teachers, that you look after teachers. Yeah? And then you realize, sometimes if you look a bit closer, you realize to him, actually, he wanted to be alone, and he said, well, actually, it's not good, you know, stay with me. And then he said, no, I want to be alone. And the Buddha said, no, stay here. Why not?
Yeah, and then he read the sutra.
Megya Sutra. Yeah? Yeah. And then the third time, you know, he wants to go away, and the Buddha says, fine, you go, you know, and the guy goes, and he falls on his flat on his
mango,
nose, you know.
Right? Mango.
Yeah. He finds a nice place and wants to meditate, and he's too young. So he goes and meditates, and he falls into he gets into trouble, yeah. And then he kind of crawls back into the fold after a while. And the Buddha gives a teaching on dependence, on looking after each other. So, the implicit teaching, and much of that is very little known, because obviously what happens with Buddhism, as with other teachings, selective quotation. People fish out of the Buddhist teaching what they already like or what they already believe. Yeah, that's how we operate, isn't it? We pick out the things we like and then we leave aside the things we don't. Yeah.
Great thing with great research,
right?
And researchers, they're not giving reality.
No,
they pick up what they want.
Selective
to say,
quotation goes a long way, isn't it? So I think much of the developmental attitude can be found in the implicit teaching of the Buddha. But that takes a different type of study than linguists are likely to provide. It takes actually living with text. It takes looking at them and see. Monastic life has taught me a lot on this, because you have to deal with discipline. And disciplinary rules, they have history and they have variations. And you have to look how this applies. And in the way you look at how this applies, you study the way these people have lived. And you understand a lot on a sort of anthropological level, how this has happened, or ethnological level to be more precise, actually get a feel how these men or women have lived and how they've handled, not just the nice bits, but what did they do when they didn't agree, you know? What consensus democracy? Fine, that sounds great, but if you've ever tried living with more than seven people and coming to consensus democracy, you realize, you know, there's a kind of law that if there's more than seven, you never ever agree on one type of consensus. So you have to negotiate somehow lack of consensus.
Yeah.
And how do you do that? So a lot of that developmental stuff I find implicit. But obviously it's more difficult to cull out, to feather out, because it's easy to say the list, you know, be alone, meditate, be good, don't do this, don't do that, yeah? So just hand that out to everybody and say, fine, and then go home, yeah? See you, come back in 2 weeks and tell me what happened. And obviously it doesn't do the job. Or you do meditation teaching, you give instructions, and then after 3 days you realize very different things are happening for people. So you fish people out and they tell, you know, when I say this, you do that, yeah? Irrespective of what I say, you do that, yeah? So we cannot help using developmental approaches. Although this is basically true, you know, this is happening. But some people need more of this, and some people need more of that, and some people fall in here, and some people fall in there. Ajahn Chah was famous for saying that people say he's contradicting himself.
Yeah.
Because he says this person needs this, and that person needs that. And he said, well, I see somebody walk down the road on the left side, and there's a big hole on the left side, and they say, walk to the right. You know? Then I see somebody walk down on the right side, and he comes and same hole, and says, walk to the left. You know? And so people say, you're contradictory. I guess it's an art to measure developmental approaches with the big picture. Because obviously if you get stuck in developmental approaches, we all say, well, we've suffered from the defaults of nuclear family, and unfortunately we can't really do this difficult renunciation, meditation, giving up business, so I need really to fulfill my needs first. Yeah. And I refuse to distinguish my needs from my desires, and I spend my life feeding my little desires, you know, believing I'm working my way up to having my needs fulfilled. So, it needs more study, it needs more intelligent application, but I think we'll probably have time. It sounds that this whole process is a several generation job, and once we've identified the task, we find plenty of ways to apply ourselves to this path. So, I'd like to stop here. Thank you for being so attentive.
Thank you.
Yeah?
The gift of Dhamma that Akinsha No is with us. It's a real gift of Dhamma. Mm.